For a long time, several minutes, the three faces in the display gazed in silence at Qing Zhao, at Wang Mu. Then, at last, the two alien faces disappeared, and all that remained was the face named Jane. "I wish I could do it," she said. "I wish I could kill your world to save my friends." Relief came to Qing Zhao like the first strong breath to a swimmer who nearly drowned. "So you can't stop me," she said triumphantly. "I can send my message." Qing Zhao walked to the terminal and sat down before Jane's watching face, but she knew that the image in the display was an illusion. If Jane watched, it was not with those human eyes. It was with the visual sensors of the computer. It was all electronics, infinitesimal machinery, but machinery nonetheless, not a living soul. It was irrational to feel ashamed under that illusionary gaze. "Mistress," said Wang Mu. "Later," said Qing Zhao. "If you do this, Jane will die. They'll shut down the Ansibles and kill her." "What doesn't live cannot die," said Qing Zhao. "The only reason you have the power to kill her is because of her compassion." "If she seems to have compassion, it's an illusion. She was programmed to simulate compassion, that's all." "Mistress, if you kill every manifestation of this program so that no part of her remains alive, how are you different from Ender the Xenocide, who killed all the buggers 3,000 years ago?" "Maybe I'm not different," said Qing Zhao. "Maybe Ender also was the servant of the gods." Wang Mu knelt beside Qing Zhao and wept on the skirt of her gown. "I beg you, mistress, don't do this evil thing." But Qing Zhao wrote her report. It stood as clear and simple in her mind as if the gods had given the words to her. To Starways Congress. The seditious writer known as Demosthenes is a woman now on or near Lusitania. She has control of or access to a program that has infested all Ansible computers, causing them to fail to report messages from the fleet and concealing the transmission of Demosthenes' own writings. The only solution to this problem is to extinguish the program's control over Ansible transmissions by disconnecting all Ansibles from their present computers and bringing clean, new computers online all at once. For the present, I have neutralized the program, allowing me to send this message and probably allowing you to send your orders to all the worlds. But that cannot be guaranteed now and certainly cannot be expected to continue indefinitely, so you must act quickly. I suggest you set a date exactly 40 standard weeks from today for all Ansibles to go offline at once for a period of at least one standard day. All the new Ansible computers, when they go online, must be completely unconnected to any other computer. From now on, Ansible messages must be manually re-entered at each Ansible computer so that electronic contamination will never be possible again. If you retransmit this message immediately to all Ansibles using your code of authority, my report will become your orders. No further instructions will be needed, and Demosthenes' influence will end. If you do not act immediately, I will not be responsible for the consequences. To this report, Qing Zhao affixed her father's name and the authority code he had given her. Her name would mean nothing to Congress, but his name would be heeded, and the presence of his authority code would ensure that it was received by all the people who had particular interest in his statements. The message finished, Qing Zhao looked up into the eyes of the apparition before her. With her left hand resting on Wang Mu's shuddering back and her right hand over the transmit key, Qing Zhao made her final challenge. "Will you stop me, or will you allow this?" To which Jane answered, "Will you kill a Ramen who has done no harm to any living soul, or will you let me live?" Qing Zhao pressed the transmit button. Jane bowed her head and disappeared. It would take several seconds for the message to be routed by the House computer to the nearest Ansible. From there, it would go instantly to every Congress authority on every one of the 100 worlds, and many of the colonies as well. On many receiving computers, it would be just one more message in the queue, but on some, perhaps hundreds, Father's code would give it enough priority that already someone would be reading it, realizing its implications and preparing a response, if Jane, in fact, had let the message through. So Ching Zhao waited for a response. Perhaps the reason no one answered immediately was because they had to contact each other and discuss this message and decide quickly what had to be done. Perhaps that was why no reply came to the empty display above her terminal. The door opened. It would be Mu Bao with the game computer. "Put it in the corner by the north window," said Ching Zhao, without looking. "I may yet need it, though I hope not." "Ching Zhao." It was Father, not Mu Bao at all. Ching Zhao turned to him, knelt at once to show her respect, but also her pride. "Father, I've made your report to Congress. While you communed with the gods, I was able to neutralize the enemy program and send the message telling how to destroy it. I am waiting for their answer." She waited for Father's praise. "You did this?" he asked. "Without waiting for me? You spoke directly to Congress and didn't ask for my consent?" "You were being purified, Father. I fulfilled your assignment. But then Jane will be killed." "That much is certain," said Ching Zhao. "Whether contact with the Lusitania fleet will be restored then or not, I can't be sure." Suddenly, she thought of a flaw in her plans. "But the computers on the fleet will also be contaminated by this program. When the contact is restored, the program can retransmit itself and..." "But then all we'll have to do is blank out the Ansibles one more time." Father was not looking at her. He was looking at the terminal display behind her. Ching Zhao turned to see. It was a message from Congress, with the official seal displayed. It was very brief, in the clip style of the bureaucracy. "Han, brilliant work. Have transmitted your suggestions as our orders. Contact with the fleet already restored. Did daughter help per your note, 14FE3A? Medals for both, if so."
"Then it's done," murmured Father. "They'll destroy Lusitania. The Pecaninos, all those innocent people."
"Only if the gods wish it," said Ching Zhao. She was surprised that Father sounded so morose. Wang Mu raised her head from Ching Zhao's lap, her face red and wet with weeping. "Ban Chen and Demosthenes will be gone as well," she said. Ching Zhao gripped Wang Mu by the shoulder, held her an arm's length away. "Demosthenes is a traitor," said Ching Zhao. But Wang Mu only looked away from her, turning her gaze up to Han Feizi. Ching Zhao also looked to her father. "And Jane? Father, you saw what she was, how dangerous."
"She tried to save us," said Father,
"and we thanked her by setting in motion her destruction." Ching Zhao couldn't speak or move, could only stare at Father as he leaned over her shoulder and touched the save key, then the clear key.
"Jane," said Father, "if you hear me, please forgive me."
There was no answer from the terminal.
"May all the gods forgive me," said Father. "I was weak in the moment when I should have been strong. And so my daughter has innocently done evil in my name." He shuddered. "I must purify myself."
The word plainly tasted like poison in his mouth.
"That will last forever too, I'm sure."
He stepped back from the computer, turned away, and left the room. Wang Mu returned to her, crying. "Stupid, meaningless crying," thought Ching Zhao. "This is a moment of victory. Except Jane has snatched the victory away from me so that even as I triumph over her, she triumphs over me. She has stolen my father. He no longer serves the gods in his heart, even as he continues to serve them with his body."
Yet along with the pain of this realization came a hot stab of joy. I was stronger. I was stronger than Father, after all. When it came to the test, it was I who served the gods, and he who broke, who fell, who failed. There is more to me than I ever dreamed of. I am a worthy tool in the hands of the gods. Who knows how they might wield me now?
12. Grego's War.
It's a wonder that human beings ever became intelligent enough to travel between worlds.
Not really. I've been thinking about that lately. Starflight, they learned from you. Ender says they didn't grasp the physics of it until your first colony fleet reached their star system.
Should we have stayed at home for fear of teaching Starflight to soft-bodied, four-limbed, hairless slugs?
You spoke a moment ago as if you believed that human beings had actually achieved intelligence.
Clearly they have.
I think not. I think they have found a way to fake intelligence.
Their starships fly. We haven't noticed any of yours racing the light waves through space.
We're still very young as a species. But look at us. Look at you. We both have evolved a very similar system. We each have four kinds of life in our species. The young, who are helpless grubs. The mates, who never achieve intelligence. With you, it's your drones, and with us, it's the little mothers. Then there's the many, many individuals who have enough intelligence to perform manual tasks. Our wives and brothers, your workers. And finally, the intelligent ones. We father trees and you, the hive queen. We are the repository of the wisdom of the race, because we have the time to think, to contemplate. Ideation is our primary activity.
While the humans are all running around as brothers and wives, as workers.
Not just workers. Their young go through a helpless grub stage, too, which lasts longer than some of them think. And when it's time to reproduce, they all turn into drones or little mothers, little machines that have only one goal in life, to have sex and die.
They think they're rational through all those stages.
Self-delusion. Even at their best, they never, as individuals, rise above the level of manual laborers. Who among them has the time to become intelligent?
Not one.
They never know anything. They don't have enough years in their little lives to come to an understanding of anything at all. And yet they think they understand. From earliest childhood, they delude themselves into thinking they comprehend the world, while all that's really going on is that they've got some primitive assumptions and prejudices. As they get older, they learn a more elevated vocabulary in which to express their mindless pseudo-knowledge and bully other people into accepting their prejudices as if they were truth. But it all amounts to the same thing. Individually, human beings are all dolts.
While collectively...
Collectively, they're a collection of dolts. But in all their scurrying around and pretending to be wise, throwing out idiotic, half-understood theories about this and that, one or two of them will come up with some idea that is just a little bit closer to the truth than what was already known. And in a sort of fumbling trial and error, about half the time the truth actually rises to the top and becomes accepted by people who still don't understand it, who simply adopt it as a new prejudice to be trusted blindly until the next dolt accidentally comes up with an improvement.
So you're saying that no one is ever individually intelligent, and groups are even stupider than individuals. And yet by keeping so many fools engaged in pretending to be intelligent, they still come up with some of the same results that an intelligent species would come up with.
Exactly.
If they're so stupid, and we're so intelligent, why do we have only one hive, which thrives here because a human being carried us? And why have you been so utterly dependent on them for every technical and scientific advance you make?
Maybe intelligence isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Maybe we're the fools for thinking we know things. Maybe humans are the only ones who can deal with the fact that nothing can ever be known at all.
Quara was the last to arrive at Mother's house. It was Planter who fetched her, the Pekinina who served as Ender's assistant in the fields. It was clear from the expectant silence in the living room that Miro had not actually told anyone anything yet. But they all knew, as surely as Quara knew, why he had called them together. It had to be King. Ender might have reached King by now, just barely, and Ender could talk to Miro by way of the transmitters they wore. If Keen were all right, they wouldn't have been summoned. They would simply have been told. So they all knew. Quara scanned their faces as she stood in the doorway, Ella looking stricken. Grego, his face angry, always angry, the petulant fool. Oliado, expressionless, his eyes gleaming. And Mother? Who could read that terrible mask she wore? Grief, certainly, like Ella, and fury as hot as Grego's. And also the cold, inhuman distance of Oliado's face. We all wear Mother's face, one way or another. What part of her is me? If I could understand myself, what would I then recognize in Mother's twisted posture in her chair?
He died of the Descolada, Miro said. This morning. Andrew got there just now.
Don't say that name, Mother said. Her voice was husky with ill-contained grief.
He died as a martyr, said Miro. He died as he would have wanted to.
Mother got up from her chair, awkwardly. For the first time, Quara realized that Mother was getting old. She walked with uncertain steps until she stood right in front of Miro, straddling his knees. Then she slapped him with all her strength across the face. It was an unbearable moment, an adult woman striking a helpless cripple. That was hard enough to see. But Mother striking Miro, the one who had been their strength and salvation all through their childhood, that could not be endured. Ella and Grego leaped to their feet and pulled her away, dragging her back to her chair. What are you trying to do? Cried Ella. Hitting Miro won't bring King back to us. Him and that jewel in his ear, Mother shouted. She lunged toward Miro again. They barely held her back, despite her seeming feebleness. What do you know about the way people want to die? Quara had to admire the way Miro faced her, unabashed, even though his cheek was red from her blow.
I know that death is not the worst thing in this world, said Miro.
Get out of my house, said Mother. Miro stood up.
You aren't grieving for him, he said. You don't even know who he was.
Don't you dare say that to me. If you loved him, you wouldn't have tried to stop him from going, said Miro. His voice wasn't loud, and his speech was thick and hard to understand. They listened, all of them, in silence. Even Mother, in anguished silence. For his words were terrible. But you don't love him. You don't know how to love people. You only know how to own them. And because people will never act just like you want them to, Mother, you'll always feel betrayed. And because eventually everybody dies, you'll always feel cheated. But you're the cheat, Mother. You're the one who uses our love for you to try to control us.
Miro, said Ella.
Quara recognized the tone in Ella's voice. It was as if they were all little children again, with Ella trying to calm Miro, to persuade him to soften his judgment. Quara remembered hearing Ella speak to him that way once when Father had just beaten Mother. And Miro said, "I'll kill him. He won't live out this night." This was the same thing. Miro was saying vicious things to Mother, words that had the power to kill. Only Ella couldn't stop him in time, not now, because the words had already been said. His poison was in Mother now, doing its work, seeking out her heart to burn it up. "You heard, Mother," said Grego. "Get out of here." "I'm going," said Miro, "but I said only the truth." Grego strode toward Miro, took him by the shoulders, and bodily propelled him toward the door. "You're not one of us," said Grego. "You've got no right to say anything to us." Quara shoved herself between them, facing Grego. "If Miro hasn't earned the right to speak in this family, then we aren't a family." "You said it," murmured Oliado. "Get out of my way," said Grego. Quara had heard him speak threateningly before, 1,000 times at least, but this time, standing so close to him, his breath in her face, she realized that he was out of control. That the news of Keen's death had hit him hard, that maybe at this moment he wasn't quite sane. "I'm not in your way," said Quara. "Go ahead. Knock a woman down, shove a cripple. It's in your nature, Grego. You were born to destroy things. I'm ashamed to belong to the same species as you, let alone the same family." Only after she spoke did she realize that maybe she was pushing Grego too far. After all these years of sparring between them, this time she had drawn blood. His face was terrifying. But he didn't hit her. He stepped around her, around Miro, and stood in the doorway, his hands on the doorframe, pushing outward as if he were trying to press the walls out of his way. Or perhaps he was clinging to the walls, hoping they could hold him in. "I'm not going to let you make me angry at you, Quara," said Grego. "I know who my enemy is." Then he was gone, out the door into the new darkness. A moment later, Miro followed, saying nothing more. Ella spoke as she also walked to the door. "Whatever lies you may be telling yourself, Mother, it wasn't Ender or anyone else who destroyed our family here tonight. It was you." Then she was gone. Oliado got up and left, wordlessly. Quara wanted to slap him as he passed her, to make him speak. "Have you recorded everything in your computer eyes, Oliado? Have you got all the pictures etched in your memory? Well, don't be too proud of yourself. I may have only a brain of tissues to record this wonderful night in the history of the Hibera family, but I'll bet my pictures are every bit as clear as yours." Mother looked up at Quara. Mother's face was streaked with tears. Quara couldn't remember. Had she seen Mother weep before? "So you're all that's left," said Mother. "Me?" said Quara. "I'm the one you cut off from access to the lab, remember? I'm the one you cut off from my life's work. Don't expect me to be your friend." Then Quara too left, walked out into the night air feeling invigorated, justified. Let the old hag think about that one for a while. See if she likes feeling cut off, the way she made me feel. It was maybe 5 minutes later when Quara was nearly to the gate, when the glow of her riposte had faded, that she began to realize what she had done to her mother. What they all had done. Left Mother alone. Left her feeling that she had lost not just King, but her entire family. That was a terrible thing to do to her, and Mother didn't deserve it. Quara turned at once and ran back to the house, but as she came through the door, Ella also entered the living room from the other door, the one that led back farther into the house. "She isn't here," said Ella.
"Nossa Senora," said Quara. "I said such awful things to her."
"We all did.
She needed us. King is dead, and all we could do..."
When she hit Miro like that, it was... To her surprise, Quara found herself weeping, clinging to her older sister. "Am I still a child, then, after all?"
"Yes, I am.
We all are. And Ella is still the only one who knows how to comfort us. Ella, was Keen the only one who held us together?" Aren't we a family anymore, now that he's gone?
I don't know, said Ella.
What can we do?
In answer, Ella took her hand and led her out of the house. Quada asked where they were going, but Ella wouldn't answer, just held her hand and led her along. Quada went willingly. She had no good idea of what to do, and it felt safe somehow just to follow Ella. At first, she thought Ella was looking for Mother, but no. She didn't head for the lab or any other likely place. Where they ended up surprised her even more. They stood before the shrine that the people of Lusitania had erected in the middle of the town. The shrine to Gusto and Sila, their grandparents. The xenobiologists who had first discovered a way to contain the Descolada virus and thus save the human colony on Lusitania. Even as they found the drugs that would stop the Descolada from killing people, they themselves had died, too far gone with the infection for their own drug to save them. The people adored them, built the shrine, called them Os Venerados even before the church beatified them. And now that they were only one step away from canonization as saints, it was permitted to pray to them. To Quara's surprise, that was why Ella had come here. She knelt before the shrine, and even though Quara really wasn't much of a believer, she knelt beside her sister. Grandfather, grandmother, pray to God for us. Pray for the soul of our brother Estevan. Pray for all our souls. Pray to Christ to forgive us. That was a prayer in which Quara could join with her whole heart. Protect your daughter, our mother. Protect her from her grief and anger, and make her know that we love her, and that you love her, and that God loves her. If he does, oh, please, tell God to love her, and don't let her do anything crazy. Quara had never heard anyone pray like this. It was always memorized prayers, or written down prayers, not this gush of words. But then, Os Venerados were not like any other saints or blessed ones. They were grandmother and grandfather, even though we never met them in our lives. Tell God that we've had enough of this, said Ella. We have to find a way out of all this. Piggies killing humans, this fleet that's coming to destroy us, the Descolada trying to wipe everything out, our family hating each other. Find us a way out of this, grandfather, grandmother. Or if there isn't a way, then get God to open up a way, because this can't go on. Then an exhausted silence, both Ella and Quara breathing heavily. Em nome do Pai, e do Filio, e do Spirito Santo, said Ella.
Amen.
Amen, whispered Quara. Then Ella embraced her sister, and they wept together in the night.
Valentine was surprised to find that the mayor and the bishop were the only other people at the emergency meeting. Why was she there? She had no constituency, no claim to authority. Mayor Covano Zeliejo pulled up a chair for her. All the furniture in the bishop's private chamber was elegant, but the chairs were designed to be painful. The seat was so shallow from front to back that to sit at all, you had to keep your buttocks right up against the back. And the back itself was ramrod straight, with no allowances at all for the shape of the human spine, and it rose so high that your head was pushed forward. If you sat on one for any length of time, the chair would force you to bend forward, to lean your arms on your knees. Perhaps that was the point, thought Valentine, chairs that make you bow in the presence of God. Or perhaps it was even more subtle. The chairs were designed to make you so physically uncomfortable that you longed for a less corporeal existence. Punish the flesh so you'll prefer to live in the spirit.
You look puzzled, said Bishop Peregrino.
I can see why the two of you would confer in an emergency, said Valentine. Did you need me to take notes?
Sweet humility, said Peregrino. But we have read your writings, my daughter, and we would be fools not to seek out your wisdom in a time of trouble. Whatever wisdom I have, I'll give you, said Valentine, but I wouldn't hope for much. With that, Mayor Covano plunged into the subject of the meeting. There are many long-term problems, he said, but we won't have much chance to solve those if we don't solve the immediate one. Last night, there was some kind of quarrel at the Hibera house. Why must our finest minds be grouped in our most unstable family? Murmured the bishop. They aren't the most unstable family, Bishop Pellegrino, said Valentine. They're merely the family whose inner quakings cause the most perturbation at the surface. Other families suffer much worse turmoil, but you never notice because they don't matter so much to the colony. The bishop nodded sagely, but Valentine suspected that he was annoyed at being corrected on so trivial a point. Only it wasn't trivial, she knew. If the bishop and the mayor started thinking that the Hibera family was more unstable than in fact it was, they might lose trust in Ella or Miro or Novinia, all of whom were absolutely essential if Lusitania were to survive the coming crises. For that matter, even the most immature ones, Quara and Grego, might be needed. They had already lost King, probably the best of them all. It would be foolish to throw the others away as well. Yet if the colony's leaders were to start misjudging the Hiberas as a group, they would soon misjudge them as individuals, too. Last night, Mayor Covano continued, the family dispersed, and as far as we know, few of them are speaking to any of the others. I tried to find Novinia, and only recently learned that she has taken refuge with the Children of the Mind of Christ, and won't see or speak to anyone. Ella tells me that her mother has put a seal on all the files in the xenobiology laboratory, so that work there has come to an absolute standstill this morning. Quara is with Ella, believe it or not. The boy Miro is outside the perimeter somewhere. Olliado is at home, and his wife says he has turned his eyes off, which is his way of withdrawing from life. So far, said Pellegrino, it sounds like they're all taking Father Esteban's death very badly. I must visit with them and help them. All of these are perfectly acceptable grief responses, said Covano, and I wouldn't have called this meeting if this were all. As you say, Your Grace, you would deal with this as their spiritual leader without any need for me. Grego, said Valentine, realizing who had not been accounted for in Covano's list. Exactly, said Covano. His response was to go into a bar, several bars before the night was over, and tell every half-drunk paranoid bigot in Milagre, of which we have our fair share, that the piggies have murdered Father King in cold blood.
Que Deus no sabensoa,
murmured Bishop Pellegrino. One of the bars had a disturbance, said Covano. Window shattered, chairs broken, two men hospitalized. A brawl? Asked the bishop. Not really. Just anger vented in general. So they got it out of their system. I hope so, said Covano. But it seemed only to stop when the sun came up and when the constable arrived. Constable? Asked Valentine. Just one? He heads a volunteer police force, said Covano. Like the volunteer fire brigade. 2-hour patrols. We woke some up. It took 20 of them to quiet things down. We only have about 50 on the whole force, usually with only 4 on duty at any one time. They usually spend the night walking around telling each other jokes. And some of the off-duty police were among the ones trashing the bar. So you're saying they're not terribly reliable in an emergency? Oh, they behaved splendidly last night, said Covano. The ones who were on duty, I mean. Still, there's not a hope of them controlling a real riot, said Valentine.
They handled things last night, said Bishop Pellegrino. Tonight, the first shock will have worn off.
On the contrary, said Valentine. Tonight, the word will have spread. Everyone will know about King's death, and the anger will be all the hotter. Perhaps, said Mayor Covano. But what worries me is the next day.
when Andrew brings the body home. Father Estevan wasn't all that popular a figure. He never went drinking with the boys, but he was a kind of spiritual symbol. As a martyr, he'll have a lot more people wanting to avenge him than he ever had disciples wanting to follow him during his life. So you're saying we should have a small and simple funeral, said Pellegrino. I don't know, said Covano. Maybe what the people need is a big funeral where they can vent their grief and get it all out and over with.
The funeral is nothing, said Valentine. Your problem is tonight.
Why tonight? Said Covano. The first shock of the news of Father Estevan's death will be over. The body won't be back till tomorrow. What's tonight?
Tonight you will have to close all the bars. Don't allow any alcohol to flow. Arrest Grego and confine him until after the funeral. Declare a curfew at sundown and put every policeman on duty. Patrol the city all night in groups of four with nightsticks and sidearms.
Our police don't have sidearms.
Well, give them sidearms anyway. They don't have to load them, they just have to have them. A nightstick is an invitation to argue with authority because you can always run away.
A pistol is an incentive to behave politely.
Oh, this sounds very extreme, said Bishop Pellegrino. A curfew? What about night shifts?
Cancel all but vital services.
Forgive me, Valentine, said Mayor Covano. But if we overreact so badly, won't that just blow things out of proportion? Maybe even cause the kind of panic we want to avoid?
You've never seen a riot, have you?
Well, only what happened last night, said the mayor.
Milagre is a very small town, said Bishop Pellegrino. Only about 15,000 people.
We're hardly large enough to have a real riot. That's for big cities on heavily populated worlds.
It's not a function of population size, said Valentine. It's a function of population density and public fear. Your 15,000 people are crammed together in a space hardly large enough to be the downtown of a city. They have a fence around them, by choice, because outside that fence there are creatures who are unbearably strange and who think they own the whole world, even though everybody can see vast prairies that should be open for humans to use, except the piggies refuse to let them. The city has been scarred by plague, and now they're cut off from every other world, and there's a fleet coming sometime in the near future to invade and oppress and punish them. And in their minds, all of it, is the piggies' fault. Last night they first learned that the piggies have killed again, even after they took a solemn vow not to harm a human being. No doubt Grego gave them a very colorful account of the piggies' treachery. The boy has a way with words, especially nasty ones. And the few men who were in the bars reacted with violence. I assure you, things will only be worse tonight, unless you head them off.
If we take that kind of oppressive action, they'll think we're panicking, said Bishop Pellegrino.
They'll think you're firmly in control. The level-headed people will be grateful to you. You'll restore public trust.
I don't know, said Mayor Covano. No mayor has ever done anything like that before.
No other mayor ever had the need.
People will say that I used the slightest excuse to take dictatorial powers.
Maybe they will, said Valentine.
They'll never believe that there would have been a riot.
So perhaps you'll get defeated in the next election, said Valentine. What of that?
Pellegrino laughed aloud. She thinks like a cleric, he said. I'm willing to lose an election in order to do the right thing, said Covano, a little resentfully.
You're just not sure it's the right thing, said Valentine.
Well, you can't know that there'll be a riot tonight, said Covano.
Yes, I can, said Valentine. I promise that unless you take firm control right now and stifle any possibility of crowds forming tonight, you will lose a lot more than the next election.
The bishop was still chuckling. Oh, this doesn't sound like the woman who told us that whatever wisdom she had, she would share, but we mustn't hope for much.
If you think I'm overreacting, what do you propose?
I'll announce a memorial service for King tonight, and prayers for peace and calm.
That will bring to the cathedral exactly the people who would never be part of a riot anyway, said Valentine.
You don't understand how important faith is to the people of Lusitania, said Pellegrino. And you don't understand how devastating fear and rage can be, and how quickly religion and civilization and human decency are forgotten when a mob forms.
I'll put all the police on alert tonight, said Mercovano, and put half of them on duty from dusk to midnight. But I won't close the bars or declare a curfew. I want life to go on as normally as possible. If we started changing everything, shutting everything down, we'd just be giving them more reasons to be afraid and angry.
You'd be giving them a sense that authority was in command, said Valentine. You'd be taking action that was commensurate with the terrible feelings they have. They'd know that somebody was doing something.
You are very wise, said Bishop Pellegrino. And this would be the best advice for a large city, especially on a planet less true to the Christian faith. But we are a mere village, and the people are pious. They don't need to be bullied. They need encouragement and solace tonight, not curfews and closings and pistols and patrols.
These are your choices to make, said Valentine. As I said, what wisdom I have, I share.
And we appreciate it. You can be sure I'll be watching things closely tonight, said Cavano.
Thank you for inviting me, said Valentine. But as you can see, as I predicted, it didn't come to much. She got up from her chair, her body aching from sitting so long in that impossible posture. She had not bowed herself forward, nor did she bow even now, as the bishop extended his hand to be kissed. Instead, she shook his hand firmly, then shook Mayor Covano's hand, as equals, as strangers. She left the room, burning inside. She had warned them and told them what they ought to do. But like most leaders who had never faced a real crisis, they didn't believe that anything would be different tonight from most other nights. People only really believe in what they've seen before. After tonight, Covano will believe in curfews and closings at times of public stress. But by then it will be too late. By then they will be counting the casualties. How many graves would be dug beside kings, and whose bodies would go into them? Though Valentine was a stranger here, and knew very few of the people, she couldn't just accept the riot as inevitable. There was only one other hope. She would talk to Grego. Try to persuade him of the seriousness of what was happening here. If he went from bar to bar tonight, counseling patients, speaking calmly, then the riot might be forestalled. Only he had any chance of doing it. They knew him. He was King's brother. He was the one whose words had so angered them last night. Enough men might listen to him that the riot might be contained, forestalled, channeled. She had to find Grego. If only Ender were here. She was a historian. He had actually led men into battle. Well, boys, actually. He had led boys. But it was the same thing. He'd know what to do. Why is he away now? Why is this in my hands? I haven't the stomach for violence and confrontation. I never have. That's why Ender was born in the first place. A third child, conceived at government request, in an era when parents weren't usually allowed to have more than two without devastating legal sanctions. Because Peter had been too vicious, and she, Valentine, had been too mild. Ender would have talked the mayor and the bishop into acting sensibly. And if he couldn't, he would have known how to go into town himself, calm things down, keep things under control. As she wished for Ender to be with her, though, she knew that even he couldn't control what was going to happen tonight. Maybe even what she had suggested wouldn't have been enough. She had based her conclusions about what would happen tonight on all that she had seen and read on many different worlds in many different times. Last night's conflagration would definitely spread much farther tonight. But now she was beginning to realize that things might be even worse than she had first assumed. The people of Lusitania had lived in unexpressed fear on an alien world for far too long.
Every other human colony had immediately spread out, taken possession of their world, made it their own within a few generations. The humans of Lusitania still lived in a tiny compound, a virtual zoo with terrifying, swine-like creatures peering in at them through the bars. What was pent up within these people could not be estimated. It probably could not even be contained. Not for a single day. The deaths of Libo and Pipo in past years had been bad enough, but they had been scientists, working among the piggies. With them it was like airplane crashes or starship explosions. If only the crew was aboard, then the public didn't get quite so upset. The crew was being paid for the risk they took. Only when civilians were killed did such accidents cause fear and outrage. And in the minds of the people of Lusitania, King was an innocent civilian. No, more than that. He was a holy man, bringing brotherhood and holiness to these undeserving half-animals. Killing him was not just bestial and cruel, it was also sacrilege. The people of Lusitania were every bit as pious as Bishop Peregrino thought. What he forgot was the way pious people had always reacted to insults against their god. Peregrino didn't remember enough of Christian history, thought Valentine, or perhaps he simply thought that all that sort of thing had ended with the Crusades. If the cathedral was, in fact, the center of life in Lusitania, if the people were devoted to their priests, why did Peregrino imagine that their grief at the murder of a priest could be expressed in a simple prayer service? It would only add to their fury if the bishop seemed to think that King's death was nothing much. He was adding to the problem, not solving it. She was still searching for Grego when she heard the bells start to toll. The call to prayer. Yet this was not a normal time for Mass. People must be looking up in surprise at the sound, wondering, why is the bell tolling? And then remembering. Father Esteban is dead. Father King was murdered by the piggies. Oh yes, Peregrino, what an excellent idea, ringing that prayer bell. That will help the people feel like things are calm and normal. From all wise men, O Lord, protect us.
Miro lay curled in a bend of one of humans' roots. He had not slept much the night before, if at all, yet even now he lay there unstirring, with pequeninos coming and going all around him, the sticks beating out rhythms on humans' and rooters' trunks. Miro heard the conversations, understanding most of them, even though he wasn't yet fluent in father tongue, because the brothers made no effort to conceal their own agitated conversations from him. He was Miro, after all. They trusted him, so it was all right for him to realize how angry and afraid they were. The father tree named Warmaker had killed a human, and not just any human. He and his tribe had murdered Father Esteban, the most beloved of human beings after only the speaker for the dead himself. It was unspeakable. What should they do? They had promised the speaker not to make war on each other anymore, but how else could they punish Warmaker's tribe and show the humans that the Pequeninos repudiated their vicious act? War was the only answer. All the brothers of every tribe attacking Warmaker's forest and cutting down all their trees except those known to have argued against Warmaker's plan. And their mother tree? That was the debate that still raged, whether it was enough to kill all the brothers and complicit father trees in Warmaker's forest, or whether they should cut down the mother tree as well, so that there was no chance of any of Warmaker's seed taking root in the world again. They would leave Warmaker alive long enough to see the destruction of his tribe, and then they would burn him to death, the most terrible of all executions, and the only time the Pequeninos ever used fire within a forest. Miro heard all this, and wanted to speak, wanted to say, what good is all this now? But he knew that the Pequeninos could not be stopped. They were too angry now. They were angry partly because of grief at King's death, but also in large part because they were ashamed. Warmaker had shamed them all by breaking their treaty. Humans would never trust the Pequeninos again,
unless they destroyed Warmaker and his tribe utterly. The decision was made. Tomorrow morning, all the brothers would begin the journey toward Warmaker's forest. They would spend many days gathering, because this had to be an action of all the forests of the world together. When they were ready, with Warmaker's forest utterly surrounded, then they would destroy it so thoroughly that no one would ever guess that there had once been a forest there. The humans would see it. Their satellites would show them how the Pequeninos dealt with treaty breakers and cowardly murderers. Then the humans would trust the Pequeninos again. Then the Pequeninos could lift up their heads without shame in the presence of a human. Gradually, Miro realized that they were not just letting him overhear their conversations and deliberations. They were making sure he heard and understood all they were doing. They expect me to take the word back to the city. They expect me to explain to the humans of Lusitania exactly how the Pequeninos plan to punish King's murderers. Don't they realize that I'm a stranger here now? Who would listen to me among the humans of Lusitania? Me, a crippled boy out of the past, whose speech is so slow and hard to follow. I have no influence over other humans. I barely have influence over my own body. Still, it was Miro's duty. He got up slowly, unknotting himself from his place amid humans' roots. He would try. He would go to Bishop Peregrino and tell him what the Pequeninos were planning. Bishop Peregrino would spread the word, and then the people could all feel better knowing that thousands of innocent Pequenino infants would be killed to make up for the death of one man. What are Pequenino babies, after all? Just worms living in the dark belly of a mother tree. It would never occur to these people that there was scant moral difference between this mass murder of Pequenino babies and King Herod's slaughter of the innocents at the time of Jesus' birth. This was justice they were pursuing. What is the complete obliteration of a tribe of Pequeninos compared with that?
Grego, standing in the middle of the grassy square, the crowd alert around me, each of them connected to me by a taut, invisible wire, so that my will is their will. My mouth speaks their words. Their hearts beat to my rhythm. I've never felt this before, this kind of life, to be part of a group like this, and not just part of it, but the mind of it, the center, so that myself includes all of them, hundreds of them. My rage is their rage. Their hands are my hands. Their eyes see only what I show them. The music of it, the cadence of invocation, answer, invocation, answer. The bishop says that we'll pray for justice, but is that enough for us? No. The Pequeninos say that they'll destroy the forest that murdered my brother, but do we believe them? No. They complete my phrases. When I have to stop to breathe in, they shout for me, so that my voice is never stilled, but rises out of the throats of 500 men and women. The bishop came to me, full of peace and patience. The mayor came to me with his warnings of police and riot and his hints of prison. Valentine came to me, all icy intellect, speaking of my responsibility. All of them know my power, power I never even knew I had, power that began only when I stopped obeying them and finally spoke what was in my heart to the people themselves. Truth is my power. I stopped deceiving the people and gave them the truth, and now see what I become, what we've become together. If anybody punishes the swine for killing King, it should be us. A human life should be avenged by human hands. They say that the sentence for the murderers is death, but we're the only ones who have the right to appoint the executioner. We're the ones who have to make sure the sentence is carried out. Yes, yes. They let my brother die in the agony of the Descolada. They watched his body burn from the inside out. Now we'll burn that forest to the ground. Burn them. Fire. Fire. See how they strike matches, how they tear up tufts of grass and light them. The flame we'll light together. Tomorrow we'll leave on the punitive expedition. Tonight! Tonight! Now! Tomorrow! We can't go tonight. We have to collect water and supplies. Now! Tonight! Burn! I tell you, we can't get there in a single night. It's hundreds of kilometers away. It'll take days to get there. The piggies are right over the fence. Not the ones that killed King. They're all murdering little bastards. These are the ones that killed Lebo, aren't they? They killed Pipo and Lebo. They're all murderers. Burn them tonight. Burn them all. Lusitania for us, not for animals. Are they insane? How can they think that he would let them kill these piggies? They haven't done anything. It's Warmaker. Blood sprays in a wide arc and spatters into Grego's face as he lunges forward, trying to stop them. Did I know this one? Did I know this Pequenino's voice before it was torn into this cry of agony and death? I can't put this back together again. They've broken him. Her. Broken her. A wife. A never-seen wife. Then we must be near the middle of the forest, and that giant must be the mother tree.
Here's a killer tree if I ever saw one.
Around the perimeter of the clearing where the great tree stood, the lesser trees suddenly began to lean, then toppled down, broken off at the trunks. For a moment, Grego thought that it was humans cutting them down, but now he realized that no one was near those trees. They were breaking off by themselves, throwing themselves down to their deaths in order to crush the murdering humans under their trunks and branches, trying to save the mother tree. For a moment, it worked. Men screamed in agony. Perhaps a dozen or two were crushed or trapped or broken under the falling trees. But then all had fallen that could. And still the mother tree stood there, her trunk undulating strangely as if some inner peristalsis were at work, swallowing deeply.
"Let it live!" cried Grego. "It's the mother tree! She's innocent!"
But he was drowned out by the cries of the injured and trapped, and by the terror as they realized that the forest could strike back, that this was not all a vengeful game of justice and retribution, but a real war with both sides dangerous.
"Burn it! Burn it!"
The chant was loud enough to drown out the cries of the dying. And now the leaves and branches of the fallen trees were stretched out toward the mother tree. They lighted those branches, and they burned readily. A few men came to their senses enough to realize that a fire that burned the mother tree would also burn the men pinned under the fallen brother trees, and they began to try to rescue them. But most of the men were caught up in the passion of their success. To them, the mother tree was Warmaker, the killer. To them, it was everything alien in this world, the enemy who kept them inside a fence, the landlord who had arbitrarily restricted them to one small plot of land on a world so wide. The mother tree was all oppression and all authority, all strangeness and danger, and they had conquered it. Grego recoiled from the screaming of the trapped men who watched the fire approaching, from the howls of the men the fire had reached, the triumphant chanting of the men who had done this murder.
"For King and Christ! For King and Christ!"
Almost Grego ran away. Unable to bear what he could see and smell and hear, the bright orange flames, the smell of roasting man flesh, and the crackling of the living wood ablaze. But he did not run. Instead, he worked beside the others who dashed forward to the very edge of the flame to pry living men out from under the fallen trees. He was singed, and once his clothing caught on fire, but the hot pain of that was nothing. It was almost merciful, because it was the punishment that he deserved. He should have died in this place. He might even have done it, might even have plunged himself so deeply into the fire that he could never come out until his crime was purged out of him, and all that was left was bone and ash. But there were still broken people to pull out of the fire's reach, still lives to save. Besides, someone beat out the flames on his shoulder and helped him lift the tree so the boy who lay under it could wriggle free, and how could he die when he was part of something like this, part of saving this child?
"For King and Christ,"
the boy whimpered as he crab-crawled out of the way of the flames. Here he was. The boy whose words had filled the silence and turned the crowd into this direction. "You did it," thought Grego. "You tore them away from me." The boy looked up at him and recognized him.
"Grego!"
he cried, and lunged forward. His arms enfolded Grego around the thighs, his head pressed against Grego's hip.
"Uncle Grego!"
It was Olhado's oldest boy, Nimbo.
"We did it!" cried Nimbo. "For Uncle King!"
The flames crackled. Grego picked up the boy and carried him, staggering, out of the reach of the hottest flames, and then farther out, into the darkness, into a place where it was cool. All the men were driven this way, the flames hurting them, the wind driving the flames. Most were like Grego, exhausted, frightened, in pain from the fire, or helping someone else. But some, many perhaps, were still untouched except by the inner fire that Grego and Nimbo had ignited in the square.
"Burn them all!"
The voices here and there, smaller mobs like tiny eddies in a larger stream, but they now held brands and torches from the fires raging the forest's heart.
"For King and Christ! For Libo and Pipo! No trees! No trees!"
Grego staggered onward.
"Set me down," said Nimbo.
And onward.
"I can walk!"
But Grego's errand was too urgent. He couldn't stop for Nimbo, and he couldn't let the boy walk, couldn't wait for him and couldn't leave him behind. You don't leave your brother's son behind in a burning forest. So he carried him, and after a while, exhausted, his legs and arms aching from the exertion, his shoulder a white sun of agony where he had been burned, he emerged from the forest into the grassy space before the old gate, where the path wound down from the wood to join the path from the xenobiology labs. The mob had gathered here, many of them holding torches, but for some reason they were still a distance away from the two isolated trees that stood watch here, Human and Rooter. Grego pushed his way through the crowd, still holding Nimbo. His heart was racing, and he was filled with fear and anguish, and yet a spark of hope, for he knew why the men with torches had stopped. And when he reached the edge of the mob, he saw that he was right. And there were gathered around those last two father trees perhaps 200 Pecanino brothers and wives, small and beleaguered, but with an air of defiance about them. They would fight to the death on this spot, rather than let these last two trees be burned. But burn they would if the mob decided so, for there was no hope of Pecaninos standing in the way of men determined to do murder. But between the piggies and the men, there stood Miro, like a giant compared to the Pecaninos. He had no weapon, and yet he had spread his arms as if to protect the Pecaninos, or perhaps to hold them back. And in his thick, difficult speech, he was defying the mob.
"Kill me first," he said. "You like murder? Kill me first, just like they killed King. Kill me first."
"Not you," said one of the men holding torches, "but those trees are going to die, and all those piggies too if they haven't got the brains to run away."
"Me first," said Miro. "These are my brothers. Kill me first."
He spoke loudly and slowly, so his sluggish speech could be understood. The mob still had anger in it, some of them at least. Yet there were also many who were sick of it all, many who were already ashamed, already discovering in their hearts the terrible acts they had performed tonight, when their souls were given over to the will of the mob. Grego still felt it, that connection with the others, and he knew that they could go either way. The ones still hot with rage might start one last fire tonight. Or the ones who had cooled, whose only inner heat was a blush of shame, they might prevail. Grego had this one last chance to redeem himself, at least in part, and so he stepped forward, still carrying Nimbo. "Me too," he said. "Kill me too before you raise a hand against these brothers and these trees."
"Out of the way, Grego, you and the cripple both."
"How are you different from Warmaker, if you kill these little ones?" Now Grego stood beside Miro.
"Out of the way! We're going to burn the last of them and have done."
But the voice was less certain.
"There's a fire behind you," said Grego, "and too many people have already died, humans and Pecaninos both." His voice was husky, his breath short from the smoke he had inhaled, but he could still be heard. "The forest that killed King is far away from here, and Warmaker still stands untouched. We haven't done justice here tonight. We've done murder and massacre."
"Piggies are piggies, are they? Would you like that if it went the other way?"
Grego took a few steps toward one of the men who looked tired and unwilling to go on, and spoke directly to him, while pointing at the mob's spokesman.
"You, would you like to be punished for what he did?"
"No," muttered the man.
"If he killed someone, would you think it was right for someone to come to your house and slaughter your wife and children for it?"
Several voices now.
"No." "Why not? Humans are humans, aren't we?"
"I didn't kill any children," said the spokesman. He was defending himself now, and the "we" was gone from his speech. He was an individual now, alone. The mob was fading, breaking apart.
"We burned the mother tree," said Grego.
Behind him there began a keening sound, several soft, high-pitched whines. For the brothers and surviving wives, it was the confirmation of their worst fears. The mother tree had burned. That giant tree in the middle of the forest, inside it were all their babies, all of them. This forest did us no harm, and we came and killed their babies. Miro stepped forward, put his hand on Grego's shoulder. Was Miro leaning on him, or helping him stand? Miro spoke then, not to Grego, but to the crowd.
"All of you, go home."
"Maybe we should try to put the fire out," said Grego, but already the whole forest was ablaze.
"Go home," Miro said again. "Stay inside the fence."
There was still some anger left.
"Who are you to tell us what to do?"
"Stay inside the fence," said Miro. "Someone else is coming to protect the Pecaninos now."
"Who? The police?" Several people laughed bitterly, since so many of them were police or had seen policemen among the crowd.
"Here they are," said Miro.
A low hum could be heard, soft at first, barely audible in the roaring of the fire, but then louder and louder, until five flyers came into view, skimming the tops of the grass as they circled the mob, sometimes black in silhouette against the burning forest, sometimes shining with reflected fire when they were on the opposite side. At last they came to rest, all five of them sinking down onto the tall grass. Only then were the people able to distinguish one black shape from another as six riders arose from each flying platform. What they had taken for shining machinery on the flyers was not machinery at all, but living creatures, not as large as men, but not as small as Pecaninos either, with large heads and multifaceted eyes. They made no threatening gesture, just formed lines before each flyer, but no gestures were needed. The sight of them was enough, stirring memories of ancient nightmares and horror stories.
"Deus nos perdoe,
cried several. God forgive us. They were expecting to die.
Go home, said Miro. Stay inside the fence.
What are they? Nimbo's childish voice spoke for them all. The answers came as whispers.
Devils. Destroying angels.
Death. And then the truth, from Grego's lips, for he knew what they had to be, though it was unthinkable.
Buggers, he said. Buggers. Here on Lusitania.
They did not run from the place. They walked, watching carefully, shying away from the strange new creatures whose existence none of them had guessed at, whose powers they could only imagine or remember from ancient videos they had studied once in school. The buggers, who had once come close to destroying all of humanity, until they were destroyed in turn by Ender the Xenocide. The book called The Hive Queen had said that they were really beautiful and did not need to die. But now, seeing them, black shining exoskeletons, a thousand lenses in their shimmering green eyes, it was not beauty, but terror that they felt. And when they went home, it would be in the knowledge that these, and not just the dwarfish backward piggies, waited for them just outside the fence. Had they been in prison before? Surely now they were trapped in one of the circles of hell. At last only Miro, Grego, and Nimbo were left, of all the humans. Around them the piggies also watched in awe, but not in terror, for they had no insect nightmares lurking in their limbic node the way the humans did. Besides, the buggers had come to them as saviors and protectors. What weighed on them most was not curiosity about these strangers, but rather grief at what they had lost.
Human begged the Hive Queen to help them, but she said she couldn't kill humans, said Miro. Then Jane saw fire from the satellites in the sky and told Andrew Wiggin. He spoke to the Hive Queen and told her what to do, that she wouldn't have to kill anybody.
They aren't going to kill us? Asked Nimbo. Grego realized that Nimbo had spent these last few minutes expecting to die. Then it occurred to him that so, too, had he, that it was only now, with Miro's explanation, that he was sure that they hadn't come to punish him and Nimbo for what they had set in motion tonight, or rather, for what Grego had set in motion, ready for the single small nudge that Nimbo, in all innocence, had given. Slowly Grego knelt and set the boy down. His arms barely responded to his will now, and the pain in his shoulder was unbearable. He began to cry, but it wasn't for the pain that he was weeping. The buggers moved now, and moved quickly. Most stayed on the ground, jogging away to take up watch positions around the perimeter of the city. A few remounted the flyers, one to each machine, and took them back up into the air, flying over the burning forest, the flaming grass, spraying them with something that blanketed the fire, and slowly put it out.
Bishop Peregrino stood on the low foundation wall that had been laid only that morning. The people of Lusitania, all of them, were gathered, sitting in the grass. He used a small amplifier so that no one could miss his words, but he probably would not have needed it. All were silent, even the little children who seemed to catch the somber mood. Behind the bishop was the forest, blackened but not utterly lifeless. A few of the trees were greening again. Before him lay the blanket-covered bodies, each beside its grave. The nearest of them was the corpse of Keen, Father Estevan. The other bodies were the humans who had died two nights before, under the trees and in the fire. These graves will be the floor of the chapel, so that whenever we enter it, we tread upon the bodies of the dead, the bodies of those who died as they helped to bring murder and desolation to our brothers, the Pequeninos. Above all, the body of Father Estevan, who died trying to bring the gospel of Jesus Christ to a forest of heretics. He dies a martyr. These others died with murder in their hearts and blood on their hands. I speak plainly, so that this speaker for the dead won't have to add any words after me. I speak plainly, the way Moses spoke to the children of Israel after they worshipped the golden calf and rejected their covenant with God. Of all of us, there are only a handful who have no share of the guilt for this crime. Father Estevan, who died pure, and yet whose name was on the blasphemous lips of those who killed. The speaker for the dead, and those who traveled with him to bring home the body of this martyred priest. And Valentine, the speaker's sister, who warned the mayor and me of what would happen. Valentine knew history. She knew humanity. But the mayor and I thought that we knew you, and that you were stronger than history. Alas for us all that you are as fallen as any other men, and so am I. The sin is on every one of us who could have tried to stop this, and did not. On the wives who did not try to keep their husbands home, on the men who watched but said nothing, and on all who held the torches in their hands and killed a tribe of fellow Christians for a crime done by their distant cousins half a continent away. The law is doing its small part of justice. Jerome Gregorio Hibera von Hesse is in prison, but that is for another crime, the crime of having violated his trust and told secrets that were not his to tell. He is not in prison for the massacre of the Pecaninos, because he has no greater share of guilt for that than the rest of you who followed him. Do you understand me? The guilt is on us all, and all of us must repent together, and do our penance together, and pray that Christ will forgive us all together for the terrible thing we did with his name on our lips. I am standing on the foundation of this new chapel, which will be named for Father Esteban, Apostle to the Pecaninos. The blocks of the foundation were torn from the walls of our cathedral. There are gaping holes there now, where the wind can blow and the rain can fall in upon us as we worship. And so the cathedral will remain, wounded and broken, until this chapel is finished. And how will we finish it? You will go home, all of you, to your houses, and you will break open the wall of your own house, and take the blocks that fall and bring them here. And you will also leave your walls shattered until this chapel is completed. Then we will tear holes in the walls of every factory, every building in our colony, until there is no structure that does not show the wound of our sin, and all those wounds will remain until the walls are high enough to put on the roof, which will be beamed and rafted with the scorched trees that fell in the forest, trying to defend their people from our murdering hands. And then we will come, all of us, to this chapel and enter it on our knees, one by one, until every one of us has crawled over the graves of our dead and under the bodies of those ancient brothers who lived as trees in the third life our merciful God had given them until we ended it. There we will all pray for forgiveness. We will pray for our venerated Father Esteban to intercede for us. We will pray for Christ to include our terrible sin in his atonement, so we will not have to spend eternity in hell. We will pray for God to purify us. Only then will we repair our damaged walls and heal our houses. That is our penance, my children. Let us pray that it is enough.
In the middle of a clearing strewn with ash, Ender, Valentine, Miro, Ella, Quara, Wanda, and Olhado all stood and watched as the most honored of the wives was flayed alive and planted in the ground for her to grow into a new mother tree from the corpse of her second life. As she was dying, the surviving wives reached into a gap in the old mother tree and scooped out the bodies of the dead infants and little mothers who had lived there, and laid them on her bleeding body until they formed a mound. Within hours, her sapling would rise through their corpses and reach for sunlight. Using their substance, she would grow quickly until she had enough thickness and height to open up an aperture in her trunk. If she grew fast enough, if she opened herself soon enough, the few surviving babies clinging to the inside of the gaping cavity of the old dead mother tree could be transferred to the small new haven the new mother tree would offer them. If any of the surviving babies were little mothers, they would be carried to the surviving father trees, human and rooter, for mating. If new babies were conceived within their tiny bodies, then the forest that had known all the best and worst that human beings could do would survive. If not, if the babies were all males, which was possible, or if all the females among them were infertile, which was possible, or if they were all too injured by the heat of the fire that raged up the mother tree's trunk and killed her, or if they were too weakened by the days of starvation they would undergo until the new mother tree was ready for them, then the forest would die with these brothers and wives, and human and rooter would live on for a millennium or so as tribeless father trees. Perhaps some other tribes would honor them and carry little mothers to them for mating. Perhaps. But they would not be fathers of their own tribe, surrounded by their sons. They would be lonely trees with no forest of their own, the sole monuments to the work they had lived for, bringing humans and pequeninos together. As for the rage against Warmaker, that had ended. The father trees of Lusitania all agreed that whatever moral debt had been incurred by the death of Father Esteban, it was paid, and overpaid, by the slaughter of the forest of Rooter and Human. Indeed, Warmaker had won many new converts to his heresy, for hadn't the humans proved that they were unworthy of the gospel of Christ? It was pequeninos, said Warmaker, who were chosen to be vessels of the Holy Ghost, while human beings plainly had no part of God in them. We have no need to kill any more human beings, he said. We only have to wait, and the Holy Ghost will kill them all. In the meantime, God has sent us the Hive Queen to build us starships. We will carry the Holy Ghost with us to judge every world we visit. We will be the destroying angel. We will be Joshua and the Israelites, purging Canaan to make way for God's chosen people. Many pequeninos believed him now. Warmaker no longer sounded crazy to them. They had witnessed the first stirrings of apocalypse in the flames of an innocent forest. To many pequeninos, there was nothing more to learn from humanity. God had no more use for human beings. Here, though, in this clearing in the forest, their feet ankle deep in ash, the brothers and wives who kept vigil over their new mother tree had no belief in Warmaker's doctrine. They, who knew human beings best of all, even chose to have humans present as witnesses and helpers in their attempt to be reborn. Because, said Planter, who was now the spokesman for the surviving brothers, we know that not all humans are alike, just as not all pequeninos are alike. Christ lives in some of you and not in others. We are not all like Warmaker's Forest, and you are not all murderers either. So it was that Planter held hands with Miro and Valentine on the morning just before dawn, when the new mother tree managed to open a crevice in her slender trunk, and the wives tenderly transferred the weak and starving bodies of the surviving infants into their new home. It was too soon to tell, but there was cause for hope. The new mother tree had readied herself in only a day and a half, and there were more than 3 dozen infants who lived to make the transition. As many as 12 of them might be fertile females, and if even 25 of those lived to bear young, the forest might thrive again. Planter was trembling. Brothers have never seen this before, said Planter. Not in all the history of the world. Several of the brothers were kneeling and crossing themselves. Many had been praying throughout the vigil. It made Valentine think of something Quara had told her. She stepped close to Miro and whispered, Ella prayed, too.
Ella?
Before the fire. Quara was there at the shrine of the Venerados. She prayed for God to open up a way for us to solve all our problems.
That's what everybody prays for.
Valentine thought of what had happened in the days since Ella's prayer. I imagine that she's rather disappointed at the answer God gave her.
People usually are.
But maybe this, the mother tree opening so quickly, maybe this is the beginning of her answer. Miro looked at Valentine in puzzlement.
Are you a believer? Let's say I'm a suspector. I suspect there may be someone who cares what happens to us. That's one step better than merely wishing, and one step below hoping. Miro smiled slightly, but Valentine wasn't sure whether it meant he was pleased or amused. So what will God do next to answer Ella's prayer? Let's wait and see, said Valentine. Our job is to decide what we'll do next. We have only the deepest mysteries of the universe to solve. Well, that should be right up God's alley, said Miro. Then Wanda arrived. As the Knowledger, she had also been involved in the vigil, and though this wasn't her shift, news of the opening of the Mother Tree had been taken to her at once. Her coming had usually meant Miro's swift departure, but not this time. Valentine was pleased to see that Miro's gaze didn't seem either to linger on Wanda or to avoid her. She was simply there, working with the Pecaninos, and so was he. No doubt it was all an elaborate pretense at normality, but in Valentine's experience, normality was always a pretense, people acting out what they thought were their expected roles. Miro had simply reached a point where he was ready to act out something like a normal role in relation to Wanda, no matter how false it might be to his true feelings. And maybe it wasn't so false after all. She was twice his age now, not at all the girl he had loved. They had loved each other, but never slept together. Valentine had been pleased to hear it when Miro told her, though he said it with angry regret. Valentine had long ago observed that in a society that expected chastity and fidelity like Lusitania, the adolescents who controlled and channeled their youthful passions were the ones who grew up to be both strong and civilized. Adolescents in such a community who were either too weak to control themselves or too contemptuous of society's norms to try usually ended up being either sheep or wolves, either mindless members of the herd or predators who took what they could and gave nothing. She had feared when she first met Miro that he was a self-pitying weakling or a self-centered predator resentful of his confinement. Neither was so. He might now regret his chastity in adolescence. It was natural for him to wish he had coupled with Wanda when he was still strong and they were both of an age. But Valentine did not regret it. It showed that Miro had inner strength and a sense of responsibility to his community. To Valentine, it was predictable that Miro, by himself, had held back the mob for those crucial moments that saved Rooter and Human. It was also predictable that Miro and Wanda would now make the great effort to pretend that they were simply two people doing their jobs, that all was normal between them. Inner strength and outward respect. These are the people who hold a community together, who lead. Unlike the sheep and the wolves, they perform a better role than the script given them by their inner fears and desires. They act out the script of decency, of self-sacrifice, of public honor, of civilization. And in the pretense, it becomes reality. There really is civilization in human history, thought Valentine, but only because of people like these, the shepherds.
Novinia met him in the doorway of the school. She leaned on the arm of Donna Christa, the fourth principal of the Children of the Mind of Christ since Ender had come to Lusitania.
I have nothing to say to you, Novinia said. We are still married under the law, but that's all.
I didn't kill your son, he said.
You didn't save him, either, she answered. I love you, Ender said.
As much as you're capable of love, she said. And then only when you've got a little time left over from looking after everybody else. You think you're some kind of guardian angel, with responsibility for the whole universe. All I asked you to do was take responsibility for my family. You're good at loving people by the trillion, but not so good at dozens, and you're a complete failure at loving one. It was a harsh judgment, and he knew it wasn't true, but he didn't come to argue. Please come home, he said. You love me and need me as much as I need you. This is home now. I've stopped needing you or anybody, and if this is all you came to say, you're wasting my time and yours. No, it's not all. She waited.
the files in the laboratory. You've sealed them all. We have to find a solution to the Descolada before it destroys us all. She gave him a withering, bitter smile. Why did you bother me with this? Jane can get past my passwords, can't she? She hasn't tried, he said. No doubt to spare my sensibilities. But she can, nay? Probably. Then have her do it. She's all you need now. You never really needed me, not when you had her. I've tried to be a good husband to you, said Ender. I never said I could protect you from everything, but I did all I could. If you had, my Estevan would be alive. She turned away, and Donna Cristal escorted her back inside the school. Ender watched her until she turned a corner. Then he turned away from the door and left the school. He wasn't sure where he was going, only that he had to get there. I'm sorry, said Jane softly. Yes, he said. When I'm gone, she said, maybe Novinia will come back to you. You won't be gone if I can help it, he said. But you can't. They're going to shut me down in a couple of months. Shut up, he said. It's only the truth. Shut up and let me think. What, are you going to save me now? Your record isn't very good at playing savior lately. He didn't answer, and she didn't speak again for the rest of the afternoon. He wandered out of the gate, but didn't go up into the forest. Instead, he spent the afternoon in the grassland, alone, under the hot sun. Sometimes he was thinking, trying to struggle with the problems that still loomed over him, the fleet coming against them, Jane's shut-off date, the Descolada's constant efforts to destroy the humans of Lusitania, warmakers planned to spread the Descolada throughout the galaxy, and the grim situation within the city now that the Hive Queen kept constant watch over the fence and their grim penance had them all tearing at the walls of their own houses. And sometimes his mind was almost devoid of thought, as he stood or sat or lay in the grass, too numb to weep, her face passing through his memory, his lips and tongue and teeth forming her name, pleading with her silently, knowing that even if he made a sound, even if he shouted, even if he could make her hear his voice, she wouldn't answer him. Novinia.